Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join us, you can grab a line right now. There's five of them. Gil is our engineer. He's the pilot of the plane. And he'll take your call. And he'll put you in queue. And then he'll say in my earphones, you've got a caller. And that's kind of how it works. Now, he also says lots of things in my headphones, but I can't repeat him for fear that both of us would be excommunicated from the radio world. So he is a really nice guy, and actually, he actually doesn't use language that my wife uses. It's close, but not always there. Talking about good shops, this portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Larry Harker's Auto Repair. They've been a trusted name in the auto repair industry, Phoenix, too. All over Phoenix since 1967. They have fast, affordable service, auto electrical work, brake services, emissions, vehicle maintenances, oil change, tire rotations, alignments, failed emissions, everything you can imagine, they can do it. They repair both foreign and domestic vehicles, and Bob, who's the co-owner with his wife Ellen, is a master tech, and he's probably one of the best diagnosticians I've ever met in my life. So, 38th Avenue and Indian School. If you've got one of those cars that nobody else can fix, then take it over to Bob, wave that red cape in front of the bull, and tell him that you've been told nobody can find and fix this problem, and he'll let you know otherwise. So that's Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Okay, I've got a gentleman in North Scottsdale who's 81 years old. He has a 65 Corvair Corsa, and it's a red convertible. It's been sitting 10 years. The top is not in great shape, and it's probably not something you'd want to keep. The car was taken to a vocational school to be painted 10 years ago. It took him about a year to paint the car, and then it was returned to him, so the car's not been reassembled from a paint job, which means window moldings and door panels and stuff like that probably are there, but haven't been installed. It has a V6 motor, and it has four carburetors, and it's a manual transmission car. So he wants to sell it. He lives in North Scottsdale, very close to Cactus and Pima, and if this red convertible 65 Corvair Corsa is something you're interested in, then you need to go through me. I'm not making any money on this. I'm just helping to interface for the gentleman who owns it. So you can email me at mark@marksalem.com, Mark with a K, mark@marksalem.com, and I'll put you in touch with the appropriate people, and I'm sure you're going to want to look at the car, and he's prepared for that. So he is getting ready to go into a next stage of his life, and so I think getting rid of the house and some of the stuff in the house, not his wife, of course, but everything else, I think that's part of the issue. We have a caller, and Gil, who would that be?
Say hello to Karen.
Karen, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Good morning. I have a 2009 Toyota RAV4, and it's shuttering. But it seems like the shuttering is, I don't know. Ask me some questions.
Oh, sure.
I don't know how to explain it.
No. This is what we do. See, guys don't do this, but me and ladies do this. Okay, the shuttering. If you're sitting at a traffic light and your foot's on the floor, does the shuttering, is it present then?
Sometimes.
Okay. When you're approaching the intersection and you're applying the brakes, does the shuttering appear then?
I think so, sometimes.
Okay. If the shuttering, if the steering wheel kind of moves left and right and you can feel the shuttering and you only have your foot on the brake pedal, then more than likely you just have a warped rotor, a brake rotor, or a drum that's out of round, and that's kind of an easy repair. Typically,
I don't think I felt it in the steering wheel.
Okay. All right. Just the shuttering. Just pay attention to does it only happen when I'm slowing down from like 45 miles to a traffic light? Not from 10 miles an hour, but we need to get you up there in speed where you're going to feel it. So if it's brake related and it's worse the faster you stop from. So you're getting off the freeway at 65 miles an hour, you apply your brakes, you're getting on the exit ramp, you're approaching the light, and the car starts shuddering. Now, if it's an engine issue, and what I just talked about was a brake issue, if it's an engine issue, then the question is the motor has two different levels. It has idle and everything else. So the question is when you feel the shudder, is it only when it's idling and not any other time when you've got your throttle going, you got your foot on the gas, or does it shudder both at idle and when your foot's on the gas? And then that shudder should really kind of go away when you come to a stop. So those are the kinds of things. Let me ask you a question. What part of town do you live in?
I actually live in Santan Valley.
Okay. You know, do you come up into the metropolitan area very often? And if so, what part of town do you usually visit?
No, I haven't been to Phoenix in a long time.
Okay. All right. I just don't know anybody to refer you to. What I was hoping to do is send you to a shop and tell you that I'm quite sure the shop would test drive the car with you. If you can show them the problem, then that would be a great idea. It would save you lots of diagnostic money. So
there's just a lot of possibilities?
Yes, there's a lot of possibilities. But if you can determine whether it's a problem at cruise or idle, that helps. And if you determine that it's only a problem from a high-speed stop, that'll help. Now,
okay. If
it's there all the time, and you feel this shuddering, and it's not there when you stop, it could be a bad tire. It could be a tire that has a separation. That kind of a thing won't be there at idle when you're sitting at the traffic light. And as you accelerate, you'll feel this, and it'll be faster, 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 faster. And the whole car will shake, or the steering wheel will shake when you get up about 50 miles an hour.
No, it's not like that. It's almost as if there's something big underneath that's loose. That's how it feels.
Okay. Oh, no, that's good. It feels like something underneath the car is loose.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it an automatic or a standard?
Automatic.
Okay. So this is what I want you to do, and I'm not going to tell you to do anything that's going to hurt you or your car. So go out there to Santan Valley Sunday morning, find a straight stretch of road, do about 45 miles an hour. You should feel what's going on. And I just want you to put the shifter in neutral.
Okay.
And coast along at 45 miles an hour and then put it back in drive. You don't have to do anything other than what I said. Take your foot off the gas, throw it in neutral, coast along for just a few minutes, then just put it in drive and continue to go. Nothing will hurt on your car.
Okay.
So if you say to the shop, let me show you how to make it, you're going to save yourself a whole bunch of money on the diagnostic part. And so that's what I would do. You have to be careful out in a new area like that, because historically all over the city, all over in the Maricopa area, when you have, like when Maricopa popped up out there southwest of the Phoenix metropolitan area, there was a time where they had some repair shops that aren't even there today. And they lasted a year. And during that period of time, according to others, they wreaked havoc on people. But out there in Maricopa today, there's repair shops that have weathered the storm and have 5, 10, 12 years of experience. That's really kind of what you want. You don't want anybody new. You don't want anybody that has been in business a year or two. I'm diagnosing this. You're probably going to need a little more. And there's not going to be any different in price. Oftentimes, the guy that's been open 1 or 2 years, his labor rate's bigger than mine because he has a bigger debt service than I do. And so it just depends. But anyway, I wish I could direct you to somebody out there, but I haven't found a good shop out there in the way Southeast Valley. But if I do, I'll post it on our website. Okay?
Thank you. Can I ask you one more thing? What is the car supposed to do or not do when I get it up to 40 and then put it on, in neutral?
I want to know if the problem goes away.
Oh, okay.
See, everything is focused, Karen, is on what makes it happen and what doesn't make it happen. And then mm-hmm. the third part of that is get in the car and I'll go show you.
2 minutes.
Let me give you an example. Okay. The diagnostic on this, by the time the technician drives it fast, drives it slow, air on, air off, left turn, right turn, braking, accelerating, and then he gets it up on the hoist, and then he's looking for the problem, and then he goes drives it again. Those are the kinds of things you want to avoid because that costs money. So if you come in and you say, now, not Monday morning or Friday night for obvious reasons, but you come in on Wednesday at 10 and you say, hi, my name's Karen. That's my RAV4 out there. And I've got a problem that it's taken me 2 weeks to figure out how to make it happen. I would like very much if you or one of your senior technicians would take a ride so that I can demonstrate the problem.
Okay.
And that's what's in your best interest. Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. When it comes to the car repair side of it, it's really important, that test drive with the technician. Not too long ago, a guy came in and he had a pickup truck. And he said, I listened to Mark on the radio and he said that you'd take a ride with me. And they said, yeah, we will. Can you make it happen? Because you can't take our technician on a one-hour drive hoping the problem's going to reappear. We need you to make sure that you can make it happen. And he goes, yeah, I can make it happen. So he takes off. We put Eddie, one of our senior techs, with him, and he takes off driving, and they're back in like 5 minutes. And he gets out of the car, and Eddie gets out and walks over to his toolbox and stuff, and one of the staffers said, you know, well, did he know what it is? I mean, did he feel it? Yeah, he did. Does he know what it is? He says he does. So they pulled this truck in, and Eddie opens up the hood, and he's got a timing light in his hand. And so he isn't under the hood for more than 15 minutes. Shuts it, says, go take it for a drive. The guy leaves. Now, we've never met this guy before. We have a work order on him. We know his license plate number and his name and his phone number, all that kind of stuff. But you know what? Go take it for a ride. If you're going to rip us off for $75, then that's fine. It cost us $75 to know that you're an idiot. But anyway, he takes off driving. He comes back and he goes, perfect. Well, the senior technician recognized that the timing was really retarded. The truck had no power at all. And when Eddie got to drive, he couldn't make it ping by really running it hard. So he brought it in. He advanced the timing. The guy goes out. He says it runs like a V8 now instead of a four-cylinder. Those are the happy things. Those are the things that if you can make it happen, and the shop has a senior tech, a gray-haired guy, not necessarily a gray-haired guy, but a guy that's been in the business for 20 years, then success is much better. 602-508-0960 is the number. If you have a car question, you're welcome to join us. 602-508-0960. We will welcome back everybody. It's 21 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, and we're going to do a little business, and then we're going to take two callers. Strictly Diesel Service and Repair is a Better Business Bureau A-plus rated shops, and he's got some of the best diesel technicians in the business. They're dedicated to providing the best service possible, get the job done right, and the first time. So at Strictly Diesel Service and Repair, they are diehard service, repair, and parts facility. They work on both foreign and domestic light diesel trucks. They're south of I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road in North Phoenix, and they're open Monday through Friday, but they also sell diesel kind of parts 24 hours a day on their website. So you can get more information on from my Best Car Repair Shops listing under the diesel shop listing. That's Strictly Diesel Service and Repair. If you've got a diesel and you got a problem and nobody's been able to fix it, he would be a good guy to stop by or call. Let's go to the phones. Bob, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hey, good morning, sir. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm looking to buy a used Lexus 2008. ES350 with 119,000 miles on it. Immaculate car, good Carfax, except for one thing on the Carfax that I thought I'd call the dealer, because I do a lot of research before I purchase any automobiles.
Okay.
And this appears to be a good machine. You agree?
So far, but the Carfax bothers me. Tell me what that's about.
It was into one of the Lexus dealers here in town, had a little oil leak from the timing cover gasket. And I went under and I looked at it. It wasn't real serious, but it is dripping in that area. I've always driven rear-wheel drive cars. The front-wheel drive, I guess they mount these V6s sideways, I'm guessing, okay?
Yeah, most of front-wheel drive cars are...
Front-wheel drive. Well, anyway, I asked the dealer, well, good, what's the cost to put a gasket on this timing cover? They quoted me $4,000. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I'm confused about this. Carfax doesn't show what we said you needed. Carfax shows they get the work orders from the dealers, and actually they're talking about getting the work orders from the independents.
Yes, that's correct. It didn't show, but I called the dealer, and they said this was a recommended repair.
Okay.
Well, 79,000 miles.
That's fine. So you've seen the car, and you crawled underneath it. Was there a drip of oil on the ground?
There is a drip of oil.
Okay, was it the size of a dime, or was it just a drop?
Small, just a drop.
Okay, is the back bumper covered with splashes of oil? Is the trunk lid covered with oil? Does this oil leak go all the way underneath the car to the back?
Seems to be isolated to the front.
Okay, well, that means it's not that really big of a leak. Now, you need to understand, or please understand, I should do it that way. Please understand that we have weeping, we have seeping, we have leaking, and we got wet. So Our industry uses those words to make the issue fuzzy. So, you know, if it's wet, if that area is wet, forget about it. If that area is weeping at 119,000 miles, forget about it. If it's leaking, then you might have to do it. But $4,000, you didn't finish the conversation with them. The $4,000 is going to be the whole front of the motor. Why would we go in there and just put a gasket in? Why would we put the crankshaft seal? Why wouldn't we reseal the water pump? Why wouldn't we look at the timing chain? We're looking at a lot of that stuff, and that $4,000 may very well be the worst-case scenario. So
it's a worst-case scenario, I'm sure, but that's what they said it was for the repair. Because they told me on the phone, it was the lady in the service car, they had to remove the engine.
Okay. Well, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. I don't know the answer to that. There's times that we do the repair without removing the engine, when in fact the labor book or the labor software says that the engine is the easiest way to remove it. So, I mean, I remember just the other day somebody brought a car in and they needed a light bulb changed, and the light bulb necessitated that we remove the inner fender liner, the plastic fender liner, in the left,
correct,
the driver's side front. And we said, there's a panel right here, and it's held on with two screws. Why don't we take the panel off, reach your arm in there, and we're done. So there's all kinds of those kinds of things. And if you brought it into us and you needed the headlight, and the headlight, you know, labor was on it was, you know, $150, and I said to you, why don't you just let me cut a square hole and let's do it, and then I'll put a patch over the square hole and I'll put four self-tapping screws in there and you're back to normal. You may choose to do that.
Right.
So, I don't know. Yeah, have you bought the car yet?
No, I'm still in process based on this repair. And I says, I'm not buying this car. It's going to cost me $4,000. I'm a stickler on cars not leaking. I'm driving a 93 BMW 5 Series with 237,000 miles on it, which was great. I just need a little more space. It's kind of tight inside, but it does not leak a drop of fluid.
Okay, well, your expectations are out of the industry standards, because your car your car has been around the world almost 10 times, and you're telling me it doesn't leak oil. That's something I've never seen before. And then you're telling me this car's got 119,000 miles and you're worried about a future oil leak. Yeah, you need to be worried about a future oil leak because the odds are against you. So you got power steering, you got transmission, you got coolant, you got transaxle fluids. You've got all kinds of fluids.
But my dilemma is, like, it appears to be these 3.5 liter Toyota engines, which is on, I think, the Camry and the Lexus, maybe something else. But it's the engine. I'm not concerned about power steering leaks and things like that. Those are easily fixable at a dealer for a reasonable price.
Yeah, you keep thinking that to yourself. Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's think about that. Oh, so you don't think that the rack leaking power steering fluid isn't going to be a couple of grand? And how about if we have to replace the pump as well? So we got the pump, we got the high pressure line, we got the low pressure line, and we got the rack. And you don't think that that's going to be minor compared to the front end? Look, you can't buy the, my advice to you is don't buy the car by what you read on YouTube University. Okay? You can have 20 people saying they hate this motor. So what? There was a lot of people that hated the small block Chevy, and today the small block Chevy and the small block Ford V8s were two of the finest motors we saw in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Then you went to fuel injection in 1996, and everybody hated fuel injections, but we now know that the first versions of fuel injection, the simplistic ones, is the best ones we had, but we have newer ones that are more efficient. So we got transmissions that we didn't think were good that turned out to be good. And we have transmissions that everybody raved about that are the biggest piles of cow manure that you've ever seen. So we have all of that. Nevertheless, 602-508-0960. David, you're next. I promise. We're going to take a quick break here in about 15 seconds, and then I'm going to take you. So David's open, but 602-508-0960 is four lines more open. 602-508-0960. My name is Mark Salem. My wife just walked in the room. She's here to keep me under control, and we'll find out how successful she is. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is my wife, Renee. We have been co-partners in the auto repair business for 39 years. She started when she was 10. I was a little bit older than that. Anyway, we're going to do what we promised, and then we're going to do our brought to you by David. You're up next. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. I had contacted you fairly recently about a problem that I have with a 2016 Taurus SHO and this black sooty stuff that pours out of the tailpipes. And I guess I didn't really describe it well. You had a couple questions, so I thought I would speak to you directly.
We're going
to
kind of speed it up this way. You complained that you had this black sooty, and you called it oil, but more than likely it's moisture, that comes out of the tailpipe of your Ford. And you went on the internet, and there was talk about some catch cans to catch this stuff that came out of the tailpipe. Is that the 10,000-foot view right there?
Basically, the catch cans go up up in the engine compartment to filter the, I guess it's the gases from inside the valve covers and stuff, before it goes back into the engine and burned again.
Okay, well, none of that makes sense. I told you that on the internet. Nothing that you're talking about makes sense. Nothing. I don't care about what comes out of the tailpipe. What you describe is moisture, this black sooty substance. If you make short trips on it, that's going to create more moisture. The catch can idea is the most craziest, dumbest idea I've ever heard in my life. So
that's what I wanted to find out.
Okay, and I don't even know why they say catch cans, because it just doesn't, nothing you say makes sense. Listen to me. Your car has a PCV valve on it. Positive crankcase ventilator. It's a vacuum cleaner. So why do we need a catch can when the motor's dead? And what are we trying to catch? Are we trying to catch the fumes from inside the engine after we shut the car off? That's crazy. I mean, there's no science to that at all. This is another YouTube University thing that causes people to come unglued about stuff that has nothing to do with it. I could test, any gray-haired guy could test your PCV valve system in far less time than it took me to say the sentence. So, and if you're worried about it, replace the PCV valve. Go down to the auto parts store, tell them you need a PCV valve for your show. Once you have it in your hand, you'll find it in the car. So go replace the PCV valve. But anything that comes out of the tailpipe that's black and sooty and watery, that's because the engine didn't get to operating temperature. So once it gets to operating temperature, the exhaust system is well over 212 degrees. The water turns to a vapor. It blows out the tailpipe. You don't see it. But my mother used to drip lots of black soot out of her tailpipe because that she just drove from her house to the liquor store and back. That's all she did.
Your mother didn't drink.
I'm teasing. They know I'm teasing. I'm teasing. And, of course, they know I'm teasing.
No, anyway, they don't.
They know.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Mark.
Alrighty,
I appreciate
Dave.
It.
Okay. Alrighty.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Walter, you're up next.
Yes. What I wanted to find out, I had my oil changed at a big dealer. And a week later, my car ran out of oil because the filter backed off.
Okay.
Now, the light never came on, but when I checked the oil, it was totally empty.
Okay.
Has that damaged my engine?
Well, it just kind of depends. Let's pretend I'm the guy that did it, okay? And when you say that the filter backed off, and how long had you driven it?
About almost a week.
Okay, that's not possible because if the filter backed off, it was loose at the beginning, and the oil pressure will overcome a loose filter, and you would have sprayed oil from the time you picked that up until a mile down the road when you ran out of oil. I think what might have happened, and this has happened to me, this has happened to my shop. I just bought a motor 2 years ago. The gasket, when you spin the filter off, the gasket comes loose of the filter and sticks up on the flange. You don't see that because this motor hasn't ever happened to you. So you screw the new filter on, but it's two gaskets now on the filter. So there's one on top and one on bottom. No matter how tight you tighten that, it's going to blow that loose gasket out. So this lady, we did that. This lady drove down. She got, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 blocks away. There's oil everywhere. So she knows something's wrong. The engine starts clattering. She pulls off the road. We go pick it up. We bring it back. Oh, my goodness. The technician, I took him out back. I whipped him with a big bull whip. But he still works for me. Yeah. And because we all make mistakes. And so what we did and what needs to happen now is we put fresh oil in it. We get the filter situated. And then you drive 1,000 miles. As long as there's no engine noises and it idles smoothly, then you drive it for 1,000 miles. And this is what we did to that lady. Mm-hmm. I then took an oil sample, and I sent it to the lab, and I said, I want all the metal content. Then she brought it back in 2,000 miles. Now, here's the deal. If the first sample had bronze in it of 7, and the second sample has bronze in it of 7,000, we got a problem. We got something coming apart in that motor. But if the first one is 7, and the second one is 7, and the third one is 7, we're home free. But we test for brass, zinc, iron, stainless steel. There's all these metals inside the engine. So if one of them is gone, well, then we've got some metal-to-metal contact, then we'll find it in the oil sample. I did, I think, 3 oil samples to put her into a comfort zone.
Right.
And she's happy, and I'm happy. But not too long ago, we did the same thing. And the customer drove it a little further than we would. We followed the oil trail to their house, man. But I had to buy a motor for that one. So you need to take it back to them, and you can kind of dictate the terms. Put some oil in it, and let's see how it sounds. That's step one. Boom, we're done. Just do step one. If everything's okay, then you change my oil and filter and fix the filter problem. I'll go drive it. I want you to take an oil sample. At 1,000 and at 2,000 and at 3,000, and I want to make sure the oil sample shows no growth of any metal. Will you accept that responsibility? And more than likely, they will. Okay?
Well, what I did, I had it told to them.
Okay.
And they weren't too happy about it. And they changed the oil, cleaned it up, started up. It did make a slight amount of noise when it started. And then they ran it around, and it didn't hear any more noise, and they said, well, it's okay. But they didn't seem very happy. They said, one insurance company has to cover it, and we got to have somebody look at it. And it looked like, you know, like you said, you take care of it. They didn't. This was a big chain company that does tires and auto repair.
Okay.
But I wasn't really happy with it.
Okay, well, the evidence is gone. So, you know, I wish you would have been out there and said, I want to watch you guys. I want to see what's wrong. But the evidence is gone. Now, in their defense, and I don't defend guys very often, but in their defense, if it ran out of oil, when we start it back up, it's going to take a while for the lifters to pump up and for the clatter of the engine to go away. But it doesn't stop here. You can go ahead, and here's the deal. Either they take care of it, because they got a big deductible. So if they got a $5,000 deductible, it's cheaper for them to just put a motor in your car and not claim an insurance policy. But you have full coverage on your car, yes? Yes?
No, I've got 100,000 miles.
No. Do you have full coverage insurance on your car? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have a part of your policy is called comprehensive, and that's damage to your car by others. So if the engine turns upside down in the next couple of weeks, you file a comprehensive claim and say, they damaged my motor. They put you back together, then they turn around and subrogate, that's the word, they go back after the dealer for the money they spent to put you back together. So we got plan A and plan B, but right now you need to go somewhere else and have them pull a sample at 1,000 miles, pull another sample at 1,000 miles. You can get on the internet, you can find oil sample companies all over the world, and they'll send you a bottle and you send it in and they give you a full report, but you're interested in metal content. That's what you're really interested in, is metal content. All right, I gotta go, but good luck to you, Walter. Good luck to you. I hope everything turns out. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open in the market, and Renee, we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem, 46 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, never mind. 46 minutes after 10 o'clock. Action Auto Repairs at I-17 in Deer Valley. Tom owns Action Auto Repair. I've owned him since, gosh, the early 80s. He's been in business since 1983. He's really good. He knows right and wrong. He knows the difference between technicians BSing him and not BSing him. He knows about our industry. When I first met him, he was the representative for this big box engine analyzer. And he could make that machine dance perhaps better than I could after years. I got pretty good with that machine, but he was better. He had a fundamental knowledge about cars, and so he knows who does and who doesn't as he hires people. So if you live anywhere near the area of Deer Valley and I-17, the northwest corner, places called Action Auto Repair, I would suggest you go in, have an oil change, and see how you like them. Let's go back to the phones real quick and pick up. We've got a caller's, and I got to get their name real quick. And do you have any idea where that might be? Oh, right here, Ron. Good morning, Ron. What can I do for you?
Yes, Mark. I've got a 52 Oldsmobile that's been restored, and my gas gauge is out. How do I decipher if it's the gauge or the sending unit?
Oh, well, you go back to the gas tank. And you find out which wire is the sender, and you cut the wire, and then you take
I've cut the wire. Go ahead.
Then it's going to either, when you ground that wire with the key on, when you ground the wire, it'll either swing to full, and then when you let go of the wire, it'll go to empty. Or the other way around. When you ground it, it'll go to empty, and then when you let go of the wire, it'll go to full. That's how you tell.
The wire I cut, I ground that?
Yes. Yes. If that's the gauge wire and it's color-coded and all that stuff, then you're going to turn the key on, and the wire that goes forward, okay, the end of the wire that goes to the gauge, that's the one we're going to ground. And it's going to swing one way, and then you let go of it, and it's going to swing the other way. That means the gauge is good.
Okay. Okay, good enough. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ron. You're welcome. Tony, you're up next. How can I help you, Tony?
Hey there, Mark. Renee, good talking with you again.
Don't say that about Renee, but go ahead. She's been yelling at me all morning long.
That's
I want you to feel sorry for me, too.
Well, hey, I'll let you deal with that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
Hey, I've got a 2002 Ford Windstar. And motor's been rebuilt.
Okay.
I've got about maybe 15, 16,000 miles on the engine. When I'm going down the road, it'll start, the engine light comes on and starts flashing. And then it starts knocking and slowing down.
Okay.
Then after a little bit, you know, about 30 seconds, it kicks back on, you know, to where it's like running normal again. Okay. I went in, I tried to take it to a shop, and it showed like EGR valve, you know, codes, stuff like that, misfires, things like that. And they said they're going to have to take compression tests of the cylinders and things like that. I mean, is that something they have to do, or is this just like sensors and solenoids or whatever?
Neither option is what we do. First of all, we go out and drive it and duplicate it. The flashing engine light typically means it's got a misfire. If it runs out of power, then we're going to look at fuel pressure. So we take it back to the garage, hook up the fuel pressure gauge to it, and go take it out again and see if that loss of power goes away or if it's still there. And if it goes from 50 pounds to 10 pounds, then we know we got a fuel pressure problem. And if sometimes it idles fine and it's nice and smooth, then I wouldn't be doing a compression test. But I would plug in a scanner and I'd go drive it and I'd be watching some of the things. I'd watch the knock sensor. And I might take a hammer when it's sitting still. I open up the hood and I'm watching the knock sensor, and I take a hammer and hit the alternator bracket, and it should go to a number that tells me, oh, I saw the engine knocking. Well, no, you didn't see the engine knocking. I'm faking you out. And then I'd plug in a scanner and I'd go drive it. And all of a sudden, all hell's going to break loose, but I'm going to be able to see the serial stream data, which is all the communication, traffic to, traffic from. And I can plug into every single one of those traffic lanes and see what's going on. So if I've got a misfire, I can figure out which cylinder it is. But a lot of times, that becomes a manual operation. So, no, I don't agree that the compression test is the first place to go. Does this shop predominantly work on cars? 90% of its stuff is working on cars. Or is it a transmission shop that converted itself to an auto repair, or, you know, an oil change shop that's giving you this stuff? I would stick with a general repair shop, you know, a chain store, a general repair, an independent general repair. That's what I would stick with. And I'll tell you this, most of the time, in that particular case, and you claim multiple codes, one of the first things I do is disconnect the EGR valve and plug it, if that's got an EGR code, and I plug it and go drive it and see if the problem was still there. Another thing is that I'd open up the EGR valve, and if it stalls or almost stalls, then I know the passageway is clean. So those are the kinds of tests we run. What part of town do you live in?
North Phoenix.
I know, but give me northwest or northeast or something like that.
40th Street, Union Hills.
40th Street and Union Hills? What about Blackwell there at 40th Street and Greenway? You could try him. I can tell you for sure Tom could find and fix this. I think your diagnostic charge is somewhere between $70 and $150. Just depends. So if you wanted my advice, Blackwell Automotive, 40th and Greenway, he's an old gray-haired guy, although he's a little bit bald. The rest of his hairs are gray, and he's a friend of mine, and he's a very good technician. So that's where I would take it. Tony, thank you very much. Eddie, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Eddie works for me. How long have you been working for me?
30 years next month.
2 months will be 30 years.
Yep.
You know, he's been with us 9 years shorter than we've been married.
I know. No, shorter than we've been in business.
Oh, in business.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. That's right. 39 years in business. Okay. Eddie, the guy brings you a Ford pickup truck. And what does he tell you briefly?
Which are the one where he turns the key off and it won't shut off? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. I should have put that
out there. Yeah, he works on thousands of Fords.
Yeah. Well, he has job security. Oh, let me fix it up. He brings this newer model Ford truck in, and you're sitting in the cab, and he demonstrates to you that he shuts the key off, he puts the key in his pocket, and the motor still runs. And then
Correct. The
ghost comes into the car. And then as soon as he grabs the door handle and he opens the door, the engine dies. And so there's boogeymen and ghosts in that truck. Is that pretty close?
That's part of it, yeah. There are a lot of different issues with that truck. He had one where the key fob wouldn't work anymore. So I had to reprogram the key fob to get it to work to lock and unlock doors.
Okay, the key fob is the button that unlocks and unlocks the doors. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, so this is a 2010 Ford Platinum F-150.
Okay.
And it also had the powered steps that when you open the door, the step would extend, and you close the door and the step would retract. And he said that sometimes when he was driving it, he could hear his driver's door, his driver's step extend, you know.
Like I said.
But I never got that to happen.
I know, but the ghost. But the ghost.
The deal, well, the deal with the key was on the ignition switch, there's three terminals that are powered up when the key is in the on position. So I was checking them to see if I had something that was backfeeding when the key was off that was keeping the engine running. Because on most cars nowadays, if you shut the key off, your radio will still play. You can still work the windows normally for up to about 7 minutes or until you open the door. And Ford used to call it, it was called the RAP module, the retained accessory power. So it appeared that something was backfeeding through that circuit on the RAP circuit. So once you open the door, it would kill the engine.
Okay, now stop. Okay, in layman's terms, he has now identified the ignition switch, and he has a wiring diagram, and he knows what's coming in and going out.
Okay.
When he talks about backfeeding, okay, you have a light switch that goes on and off, and it takes one of two wires and it interrupts those wires. So he says, I've got a circuit that's not supposed to be grounded at this time, or I've got a circuit that should not have power at this time, but it does. So that's called a backfeed. We're doing something to change that circuit, so we're providing the grounder power to it. So he's underneath the dash, his whole body. He's checking the terminals on the ignition switch, which is not where the key goes, okay? And he's doing all of this to try to determine why we have power or ground to one of these circuits that keeps the motor running. All right? That's kind of the simplest. If I can get it by Renee, I can get it by anybody.
Oh,
go ahead,
funny.
Eddie. Go ahead, Eddie.
So I'm back proving the terminals on the ignition switch with a test light. So I've got one lead to ground, and if my test light hits power, it lights up the light bulb.
Right.
Well, as soon as I touch ignition one, and I've got the door open, but I've got the door latched so I can have access to the vehicle, but the vehicle still thinks the door is shut.
I understand.
As soon as I touch the, I think it was a yellow pink wire, my test light didn't light up, but the engine shut off, and I still had the radio playing. Just like I had turned the key off, but it had not opened the door.
Okay, now stop for a minute. So of those three power leads that have 12 volts, let's call them 1, 2, and 3. On the 1, you're working on number 1 that you described as a yellow.
That's correct.
Okay, all right. So you put your test light in there, which effectively changes that circuit. And when you shut the key off, then the radio still plays, but now you can and the motor shuts off. That's what happens. The radio still plays, but the
right.
motor finally shuts off. Okay.
Right. And so it was the load of my test light that made the engine shut off. So I went back to the wire diagrams. I'm looking at the ignition switch, and I'm trying to determine this terminal has power when it is in run and start. And I'm trying to figure out when you go to off, does the ignition switch ground this terminal?
Right. It should
and
be
I really
grounded.
Couldn't figure that out. Right. But here is the weirdest thing. So I put an ignition switch in it. I just unbolted the other one, put the new one in there, and put the connector back on it. It worked fine for a half a dozen times. It worked perfectly.
Okay.
And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. So I got my digital volt ohmmeter, and I went from that wire to ground on the ohm scale to see, okay, if I shut this off, does it go to ground? The first time I did it, it went to 32 ohms, which was probably about twice the resistance of my test light.
Okay, you're getting too technical here.
But then the problem came back again.
You're getting too technical.
Well,
okay, you just found that this thing's supposed to ground. Now, I got a minute left, less than a minute left, so I'm going to put you on hold, and then we're going to finish this up. So basically, we're at the ignition switch, and we've identified the circuit that we're concerned with. And by artificially inseminating that circuit, we can actually make the engine shut off when the key goes off. So we're halfway there. When we come back, we'll be chapter 2. Chapter 2 of the Ford F-150 Platinum that won't shut the engine off until you open the door. Welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and I'm here at your service. Now, we usually have a whole bunch of phone calls the second hour, and the first hour kind of slim. So now's the time, 602-508-0960. You can talk about a car problem. You can talk about your wife arguing with you about how to use the windshield wipers. You might want to know what to say to the shop and what not to say to the shop. And I do marital counseling and all that other kind of stuff as well. So you're welcome to call us at 602-508-0960. Let me tell you about Auto Dynamics real quick. Auto Dynamics is a shop in Sun City. They're really good. They've been around since 1982. Chuck started Auto Dynamics, and his son Derek now runs Auto Dynamics. And if I do say so myself, and I would say this in front of Chuck, Derek's a tad better than his dad with respect to the big picture. But that happens to a lot of us old guys because we came up in a different century, so to speak. So whatever your repairs are, Automotive Dynamics in the Sun City area is a pretty good idea and a good place to go. If you're looking for a great shop, then Auto Dynamics is on the north side of Grand, just west of 99th Avenue. Like I said, I've known this family for many, many years, and I know they'll treat you fairly. Okay, Eddie, I'm going to recap real quick, okay?
Okay.
Okay. This Platinum Ford comes in. It's a 2010 F-150, and I think you told me that he said that he had had this to a lot of other places and nobody could fix it, or the success rate of other attempting to fix it was rather slim. Yes?
Correct, yeah. No one had a clue.
Okay. So he brings it to us because he thinks we have a magic wand, and so I assign it to you. And what you do is you determine – oh, and the symptom is this. He gets in his truck, and he turns the key on, and he starts the car, and he drives away. The motor runs fine. When he gets home, he turns the key off, and when he turns the key off, the motor stays running until he opens the door to get out, and then the motor dies. And then there's some electric steps on it that are acting kind of strange as well. So what you're trying to fix is why won't the engine shut off when he turns the key off? You identified that we have one circuit in that situation when you turn the key off, one circuit that's either hot or dead, and it should be just the opposite. So the hot one should be dead, or the dead one should be hot, and you identify that circuit to the yellow wire on the ignition switch deep underneath the dash. Have I got it right?
Yep.
Okay.
It. Yep.
Okay. So you're going to – what are you going to do to fix this car?
Well, like I said, I put an ignition switch in it, and that worked fine for 6 times. I turned the key off, the engine would shut off, and then I checked to see if that circuit was being grounded when the key was shut off. And on a scale of 1 being grounded and 10 being not grounded, it was a 3. But then the problem came back.
Okay.
So I kind of rewound the whole deal. I unplugged the ignition switch, took it off, put everything back the way with the new ignition switch, just like it just reinstalled it again, and it still had a problem.
Okay.
So at this point, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't know what was going on.
You don't think I could see that?
What's that?
You didn't think the rest of us could see that? We knew that this wasn't going to be an easy repair, so that's why I gave it to you. But anyway, so next.
So all I knew is that if I took my test light and touched that wire when the key was off, the engine would shut off. So I took my test light and I touched that wire when the engine was running with the key on. My test light was nice and bright. And as soon as I turned the key to off, the engine would shut off just like it was supposed to. So at this point, I'm just going to wire a bulb to that circuit and tuck the bulb back behind the dash where he can't see it being lit up when the key's on, and it fixed the problem.
Okay. Now, to put that in layman's terms, the circuit was hot, and when you shut off the key, it should have gone dead, and it didn't go dead. But when you applied a small load, like a light bulb, and a load is measured in amperage. Your starter takes 180 to 300 amps to crank over. When you turn on your headlights, they're probably on an 8-amp circuit. This was a very small circuit. It took very little amps to change it from hot to dead. So you decide to jump a wire from ground to this wire, right?
Correct. Correct.
And you put a bulb in there.
A little light bulb, like a dash light bulb, yeah.
Okay. Why didn't you just paint it black? So nobody could see it.
because those little bulbs get a little bit hot, so okay. It would have just put the paint off of it anyway.
All right. Okay, so you put the bulb in there, you wire it in, and fixed?
Fixed. Every time you turn the key off, boom, the engine would shut off just like we were supposed to.
Now, I'm going to tell people that we didn't really go back to the root of the cause, because that would have cost a lot more money, and it did have an aftermarket alarm system on it that had been removed, and we felt sure that somewhere along the line, somebody had crossed wires or somebody had left some portion of this alarm in there, and we knew what it was causing. So rather than go tear the dash apart and try to find this backfeed or this problem, we just decided to fix the problem by using a little light. Now, how much did you bill on the diagnostic time? I don't really know, so I'm asking you a question I don't know the answer. In dollars.
In dollars, I think I had probably about $250.
Okay, which is about 2 hours, yes?
Yes.
Okay, did you charge them for the light bulb and the wire and the connections?
Yeah, that was another $125.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay, so the light bulb and the...
What do you...
Hey, was there any parts on this ticket?
Yes, well, I probably had about $10 in parts with a couple wire connectors, the socket, and the bulb.
That's what I was looking for. I didn't believe that you charged them $125 for the light bulb and the electrical connections and stuff like that. So his ticket was between $250 and $300.
I think it was upwards of almost, with some of the reprogramming the key fob and some other stuff, it was somewhere between probably $400 and $500.
Okay, and reprogramming the key fob, when you walked up to the car and you pushed out lock or unlock, it wouldn't talk to the car. The car didn't know what frequency your button was at. So we had to go into the computer and we had to say, okay, tell us when to push this button, and then we'll push it, and you go, oh, that's the one I need to talk to. So we had this transaction going on where we had to relearn the fob to the car. We had to match the key fob to the truck, right?
That's correct.
Okay. All righty. So at the end of the day, we fixed it. But, folks, gives you a good idea what the labor, how the labor is. Now, what estimate did you give him at the front side?
You know, I think they had quoted him $125 to $150 as far as checkout.
Okay.
And so as soon as I exhausted that, then the service writer got in contact with him and said, hey, we're on the right track. We're halfway through the tunnel right now, but it's going to cost a little bit more to go forward.
Okay. So at the end of the day, you finally, it's not really a MacGyver. It's you just simply overcame the connection wherever it was at. And
right. I mean, there's two ways to look at it. I either fixed it and didn't repair it, or I repaired it and didn't fix it. But we reached the finish line and got the results that the customer wanted.
Right. And in a permanent fashion.
Yes.
Until, of course, your light bulb under the dash burns out.
Burns out.
So you told him all about that. So if it dies and it starts doing it again, then he'll know, and he'll probably bring it back to us and we'll replace the light bulb. Did you give him a lifetime guarantee on the light bulb?
No.
Well, you should have, because that way he'll come back to us and he's not going to have to spend a bunch of money figuring it out.
Well, I told him if it happens again, then most likely the bulb has burned out.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you for spending this time with me. But I just wanted, that was a tough one. That was one that I would say that maybe 10 to 15% of the gray-haired guys in town would probably be able to fix, and the rest of them couldn't. It took a lot of ability to recognize that this circuit needed to go dead instead of be hot, and that you used a very small device to make it go dead like it's supposed to, and so then you recognize that the small amount of energy could be produced by a small light bulb, and you decided to wire that in and see how it worked. But at the end of the day, when he turns the key off, the engine dies, and when he gets out, everything's okay, and everything works like it should. And at at the end of the day, it works. So anyway, thanks for calling in. I asked you to call in and talk about this. It's not to thump our chest. I'm not even going to tell you the name of our shop. I'm just going to give you an example of what we see on a regular basis. You know, I honk the horn and the headlights flash. I honked the horn one time and the airbag popped me in the face. These electrical issues are really weird. And then the worst ones are when the kid from high school decides to put a fancy-dancy stereo in his computer car, and he thinks that he grounds the stereo to a ground wire, and it's not. It's an input or an output from the computer. So now all kinds of things happen, and Daddy brings the car in, and he doesn't say anything about the kid tried to put a stereo in it, or the new stereo doesn't work right. He just says, this is what's going on. I honk the horn and the windshield wipers flap. And so we have to go in and figure that out. So it's important to let us know all the electrical history of this car, including my son tried to hook up a new stereo. I can't tell you how many times that's happened. I can't tell you in 39 years how many cars we've had come in, and they had a black wire, and they thought, oh, that's ground. So they hooked the stereo to that ground wire, and it's not a ground wire. So you can't go by colors anymore. Or they think they hooked
it to... Well, the best piece of it...
Go ahead.
The best piece of information we need is it happened after this.
Okay.
Everything was fine until we did this. Whether it was, you know,
1 minute.
I took her to a shop and they did something, or my son tried to install, you know, a stereo, or
okay,
you know, I got hit in the right front. Whatever. Okay. We need that dividing line.
Okay. And in your case, real quick, what was the action that he had to tell you about, or he did tell you about, that kind of gave you a lead on this? What did he say?
There was nothing. He said there was no rhyme or reason. He said months ago the backup camera started acting up, but I don't think that has anything to do with this issue right now.
Okay. All right. So he didn't really have much background other than, but he did give us a good path to start on. Hey, this is how you duplicate it, and I need you to fix this. And he was able to demonstrate clearly what was going on with the car. So anyway,
yeah,
it was
perfect.
Go ahead.
No, perfect symptoms and perfect way to recreate it.
Okay. All righty. Well, anyway, thank you. 602-508-0960.
Yep.
If you have a car question, thank you, Eddie. 602-508-0960. And the important part is the communication part. So that's the reason why when you ladies go into the car repair shop, you don't tell them to fix it because your husband said to do this. You give them the symptoms and let them come up with the repair. And then when they come up with the repair, ladies, you look them in the eye or you talk real firm on the phone and you say, listen, I want to hear from you that it's going to cost, you know, $237 to fix the problem, and you promise that this is not a guess, because I'm not guessing with my money, and if we're guessing, we're guessing with yours. So I want to hear you say, Mrs. Johnson, I'm going to fix your car for $237, and your problem, is going to not reappear. I'm going to fix your problem. That's what you want to have, that kind of conversation with your car repair shop. And really and truly, the good guys don't mind that conversation at all. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. 19 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock, and David's been holding for a very long time, and I'm going straight to David and take care of David's problem. David, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
No problem. Good morning. Mine is more about the anti-lock brake system. Got a 2011 Tundra I bought used. And the first time I took it up into the mountains, I noticed that when I took the I was going down a grade, and it was a sharp left turn, the anti-lock brake system would engage either on its own or the minute I touched the brake.
Okay.
Wanted to know if that was normal. Do have the truck under an extended warranty, and wanted to take it in to see if they could troubleshoot that, but I'm not quite sure what to look for and what questions to ask.
Okay. It's not really questions to ask. You just say, I need you to get on the freeway. I need you to find a sweeping left turn, and I want you to drive it that way for half of the turn, and then I want you to gently apply the brake pedal in half that return. And I'm just guessing about what you're going to say, but I'm just thinking, and you tell them, and then the ABS, now when the ABS light comes on, does it flutter, flicker, or does it come on steady?
It comes on steady.
Okay. All right. And that's what you're going to tell them. Now, I want you to think, you just give them the symptoms. That's all you give them is the symptoms. But let's talk about this for a minute. When we turn left, when the ABS has sensors on all four wheels. And when, if you're going straight down the road and you hammer the brakes and the left front tire locks up, in the blink of an eye, the ABS is going to dump the fuel, the brake fluid pressure to that left front. The sensor is going to go, oh, we just went from 0 to 52 miles an hour. Then the ABS guy goes, okay, I'm going to apply gentle brake pedal pressure to that wheel. Oh, it locked up again, and then it dumps the pressure. This happens in the blink of an eye, and that's the shuddering. When you hammer the brakes, the car shudders, and that's the ABS going on and off. In your case, the most important thing you said was, is I'm in the sweeping left turn, and sometimes I'm braking, but sometimes I'm not. So what I'm going to do is, and most shops are going to do, I'm going to hook up my scanner, and I'm going to watch all four wheels. And then I'm going to go to the Fry's parking lot, and I'm going to do left turns. And okay, sooner or later, one of those sensors is going to fall out. So it could be the left front or the right front. It could be the left rear or the right rear. It doesn't make any difference to me. All I'm going to do is I'm going to make left turns, do, and then I'm going to go right turns. And I'm just going to go back and forth and back and forth, and sooner or later, I'm going to see one of those sensors fall off. Now, before I do that, I'm probably going to put it on the rack and make sure the sensor isn't covered with mud or grease. And I may take an air gun and blow off all four sensors, make sure that the harnesses are intact and they haven't been rubbing on the tire. So I'll do an eyeball inspection, and then I'll go drive it. That's how we're going to figure it out. That's how we're going to figure it out. And you can help, too. Does it ever do it on the right when you do it right? Because if you say it only does it on the left, that helps us. Because this is the reason. When you make a left turn or a right turn, the inside tire, the left front, is going to turn less revolutions than the right front. Because the arc on the left side on a left turn is smaller than the arc on the right side of the car. That helps us. So if we get it to happen on the left and then it doesn't happen on the right, we pretty much know it's going to be a front wheel sensor. So how many miles on your Tundra?
I've got 81,000.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you have any problem. Do you have a garage?
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I don't.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I do not have a garage that I typically take my vehicle to, if that's what you're asking.
Yes. Do you typically take your vehicle to a shop you trust?
I typically do most of the work myself.
Okay.
There is a Toyota dealership that I've gone to a couple of times, but I do not trust.
Okay.
So, live in the West Valley, got somebody you'd recommend.
38th Avenue and Indian School, is that close?
Close enough.
Okay. Harkers could figure that out. Bob can figure it out. If he can make it happen, he can figure it out. But like I said, he may say to you, I want to dust off and clean off all the sensors. I want to give you the car back. I'm going to charge you $35, and I'm going to clean all the sensors up, and I want you to let me know if it comes back. Now, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to call him and say, it's been a month and it hasn't come back. Thank you very much. Or you're going to come back and say, no, I can duplicate it again exactly the same way. And he goes, okay, I expected that. Come on back and we'll continue on. That might be the process. That would certainly be the process I would want to take, because I want you to go out. Because if blowing the sensors off and it fixes it, bingo, you're home free.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. And you said that was Harkers?
Harkers, H-A-R-K-E-R-S.
Harkers. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. They've been around since 1970. Brian and Thelma own and operate Thompson's Auto Repair, and both of their respective families have been in Mesa for the last 40 or 50 years working on cars. So both of their last names, Thompson and Vivian, both of those names are names that have been around a long time. All you have to do is meet Brian or Thelma to know that they've got your best interest in front of anybody else's. They're honest, they're dependable, they have great technicians, and they work very hard to fix your car or service your car properly. They're on Main Street just east of Stapley. Great place to go if you don't have a place, and it's the only place in the Mesa Borders, the only auto repair shop that I put my name next to. The only one. It's not that they're the only good shop, but they're the only good shop that's applied and passed all the tests that I put them through. Let's go back to the phones. Tim, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
I bought an aftermarket high amp alternator, and it came with a sheet telling how many amps it puts out at each RPM. and tells when the alternator starts charging.
Okay.
I would like to take it somewhere. It's not on a vehicle, it's just in a box. I would like to take it somewhere and have it tested to make sure that their test results they gave me are true and accurate.
Okay.
Where could I take it to I took it to like AutoZone and they said,
let me answer your question. Let me answer your question. Your question is a really bad question. The outcome is not what you're going to think it is. We test parts where they live. So for you to find somebody that's going to put it on an alternator test bench is a huge waste of time. So there's nothing. I mean, I'm going to put it on a test bench, and I'm going to tell the alternator the battery just went to 2 volts, and then I'm going to look at the total output. Your car's never going to go to 2 volts. It's never going to drop below 9 because that 9 is probably going to shut off. So I don't know why you bought a high-amp alternator, but I'm going to tell everybody else that's listening to the show that that is not in your best interest. It's not. So the alternator in your car is capable of 10 to 60 amps, 10 to 80 amps, 10 to 120 amps, and amps is the power to pump electricity back into the battery. So in your particular case, you put it on the car, and then you go have it tested. We got a test bench. Well, we're not going to take it off. We're going to hook up a bunch of cables, and we're going to fool the alternator into believing that the battery voltage has just dropped to nothing, and we're going to see what the total output is. But I don't know why you did that, because there's nothing that's going to work better than the alternator that the car came with. And the high-amp alternator is just simply a marketing strategy to move you from 60 to 80. And I'm going to tell you that your alternator runs in the 60-amp range maybe once every 10 years. And that's probably when you're hooked up to your wife's car and trying to jumpstart the battery, and you bring the battery, or you bring the car that's running up in RPM. So I don't know the situation, but you test it where it lives, because a bench isn't going to give you true values. So that's my response to your question. And good luck to you. Now, there are a couple of rebuilders here in town, and if you want to find, you just Google alternator starter rebuilders in Phoenix, Arizona, and you'll probably find a couple of them. But again, unless it's in the car, the testing is not valuable, and it's not useful. So anyway, good luck to you, Tim. Thank you for holding as long as you did. Gail, you're up next. How can I help you?
Well, Gail dropped.
Okay. All righty. Well, we're going to take a break here in just another minute or so anyway. So 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. Kurt's Auto Repair is a shop I like. Kurt's Auto Repair is a shop that's been around a long time. He's up at I-17 and Bell in the northeast corner. Jeff, Eric, and Kurt are just a wonderful team. What's up?
One minute.
Okay. One, they're a wonderful team to fix cars. They're all three master technicians. You got the young guy, you got the middle guy, and then you got the old guy. And when you put three heads together like that, the outcome is always really good. So he's a family-owned, independent-operated auto facility. They've been recognized as one of the Better Business Bureau Ethic Award winners, and that says a whole bunch about their ethics. They opened up in 1987. They work on both gas and diesel, and he hates it when I say this, but if your lawnmower doesn't run or your weed eater crapped out, take it to Kurt's, and he'll check it over for you. I'm kidding. So anyway, Kurt's Automotive, northeast corner of I-17 and Bell Road, a good place to start your car repair relationship. My name is Mark Salem. Our website's marksalem.com. There you can find the list of the very best car repair shops I believe exist in the city.
All about that.
Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock, 602-508-0960. We're going to take Gail. Gail, thank you for calling back. How can I help you?
Hello. I have a 2018 Mazda 3 that I've had for 15 months, and everything works great, except one thing. I had an old flip phone that worked for 6 months connected to the Bluetooth, and then it stopped working. And so I went into my cell phone company, and they told me, your old flip phone, you need a newer one. So I bought a newer one. That one worked for 6 months. in the Mazda 3, and now it stopped working. And I've taken my car under warranty to Mazda and had the Bluetooth upgraded. And I've gone to Verizon multiple times, and we can't seem to get my phone connected back into the Bluetooth.
Okay. And we're sure that all the, they call it pairing, all the pairing process is done exactly right.
Well, they had paired the phone. And the other day I was in there and they couldn't get the phone connected. And the guy says he does this all the time. This is at the phone company.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I left, my phone kept notifying me every 2 minutes that something was going on and it was trying to pair. So I had to unpair, on the Bluetooth. I actually unpaired the phone because it wasn't, because my phone wouldn't stop notifying me.
Okay. Okay.
You know?
Do you have any kids? Do you have any daughters or son-in-laws or anything like that?
Yeah, I have a son. Okay. He's an engineer.
Okay. Here's what I'm thinking. Before we go much further, I would think that if he has an Apple phone or a Samsung phone, that he could pair his phone to your car and then maybe let
right.
you use his phone for a couple of days to see how that works. I can tell you that we oftentimes read where it says the old-fashioned flip phones, and they usually give us a Motorola model and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
will not pair or will not communicate. And I know just the other
okay.
day, my wife and I were trying to get our phones to change the channel on our new television. And when I couldn't, and mm-hmm. and I had her read the directions while I did it, then I read the directions while she did it. And so we called the 1-800 number, and he says, what are you using? And I told him, and he goes, no, that's not going to work. He says, you need version so-and-so software. And he says, and you have to upgrade mm-hmm. your phone, and then it'll work. So I said, the parameters are kind of small. And he says, no. He says, the parameters cover the last 3 years. So yours is without outside the parameters, which is 4. And so I said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I borrowed my son's Samsung, and sure enough, it worked just fine by controlling the volume in our television.
Mm.
So I think it's not in your best interest to let them start mm-hmm. replacing parts and working on your car, because this is a very unusual problem. I think you're better off to go on the phone side, because I think
okay.
it's more likely than not than a newer phone would probably fix your problem. And the cars of today.
But 6 months ago, I did buy a newer flip phone.
Okay.
And then it quit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I just don't know. I don't think they make a flip phone anymore. And I can understand that you bought a newer version of your old one. But it's
mm-hmm.
kind of like, you know, the Chevrolet and the Ford, they have older versions and newer versions. But I paid attention to the fact that you said this is an 18 Mazda 3. So
and
I think the technology on the car is requesting newer technology to talk to it. Now, the only other possibility would be is that the issue could be that, have you ever hit the key and the engine cranking over the roo, 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 sounds different?
I don't think so.
Okay,
this
I want
is
you
a
to
push button.
Okay,
car. Yeah.
I want you to pay attention to the roo, 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 roo on the starter. If it ever goes
okay.
or if it ever goes click, then it could be that there's a problem in the starting system that's dragging the battery, which is normally at 13 volts, down to 8 or 9, and that may wipe out the memory on your radio. So
but it hasn't wiped it out.
Okay, okay. And you're talking about the push buttons, what we call the presets. They still work, right?
One.
Yeah, everything's working fine on that. It's this little screen
mm-hmm.
That pops up, and it's all the radio stations are there and everything.
Okay,
that
helps me. That's a very good answer to my question.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is you might try a stereo shop. Those guys work wonders. The one we use is called Cartoons, and I think it's spelled with a K, but I'm not sure. Cartoons.
Okay.
We use them to bail us out of problems like this. I think it would be appropriate to ask to make an appointment and then stop by and just say, can you pair this better than I can? and see what they say about the technology that you have. But I think it's, I think I'm 70%, there's a 70% chance I'm right that a newer model phone might help you out better. So I hate to spend your money, but that's what I think.
Yeah, and I'm in my 60s. I'm reluctant to go to a smartphone, you know.
Well, and let me tell
because
you.
Because they're so small.
I know what you're thinking. Not too long ago, maybe a couple years ago, our company has lots of phones. And so they they said that they're not going to carry my old phone again. They called it a Fred Flintstone phone. So I have two older kids, and I have three older kids, and they're all like the other geeks that are out there that are in their 20s. They know everything about the smartphone. And it really didn't take me very long to understand the smartphone. And I'm 64, and I only graduated from high school, and I barely did that. If my dad hadn't have paid off the principal, I would have never got my diploma. So I just think, I mean, if you can work your television set, then you can go from cable to music and from music to news, and you can shut it off with push buttons. I think you'll find that the newer model phones won't be so scary. And I know that my son likes his Samsung better than the rest of us like our Apples, but then he's hit his head too many times. So that might, if we can prove that that's the answer, then you have two choices: to leave it like it is or to upgrade the phone to something that's a smartphone. Okay. I got to run, but good luck. Thank you. Thank you, Gary or Gail. I'm sorry. And Larry, you stay right there. Welcome back, everybody. 43 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Every Saturday, we're here from 10 to 12 talking about cars. I'm not here to thump my chest or to tell you that I'm the know-it-all of all know-it-alls. I'm as good as the information you give me. I'm as good as the information you give me. So when I ask you if it does it when you move real fast and you say no, then I'm going to, and the answer is yes, then I'm going to go in the wrong direction. So just do your best. And of course, every question has three answers. Yes, no, or I don't know. And so that's kind of how we work this out. You can also send me an email at mark@marksalem.com. mark@marksalem.com. And I'll answer all of them personally. If you'll leave your phone number, sometimes I want to ask you a question. And I call from a blocked phone. So if you send me the email on Sunday and then Monday at 10 o'clock, somebody calls from a blocked phone. If you don't answer, I say, hey, this is Mark Salem. I'll call you back in 15 or 20 minutes. And then that way you can pick up the phone. So that's kind of how it works. Let me tell you about Blackwell Automotive real quick. He's a guy that I've known for a very long time, for more than 25 years. Tom's the kind of guy that you can wave that red flag and tell him nobody can fix the car, and he will. He can fabricate car parts. He works on older cars. He fixes older cars, but he also works on computerized cars and diesels. He just has the kind of tenacity that a really good shop owner has. So if you live anywhere near 40th and Greenway, he's been there for more than 20 years in the same building. He's been a friend of mine for more than 20 years. And I can tell you, like most all the other shop owners, I know him personally, and I can tell you almost certainly that I have every one of their cell phone numbers. So we are a close group, and we work together. So Blackwell fits just perfectly, and he has ASE-certified technicians. So from oil change to engine swaps, domestic and imports, he can handle it all. Let's go to Larry. Larry, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Hi. I have a 2002 Explorer Sport Track. A lady hit me the other day in the front right front wheel, and it bent that big pie-shaped arm that comes to hold the wheel on. So they had to replace it. And while they replaced it, they put in new wheel bearings. I've driven the car since it was brand new. I've got 143,000 miles. I've always known what it feels like in the steering wheel. I've taken it back once, and they say everything's fine in there, and it drives just fine, but sometimes between 35 and 42 miles an hour, I can feel in the steering wheel there's a vibration, slight, but it's a vibration. Would that new pie-shaped thing coming to the wheel make the steering wheel vibration feel different than it has for the other 143,000, or is it just something that's different that I'm just imagining that I'm feeling it different in the steering wheel?
Okay.
See, everything's tight and everything's running right.
Okay. Well, that's called a control arm, that triangular piece you're talking about.
Okay.
That's a control arm. The fact that it comes and goes, I think I have a better plan for you. I think you should have asked them or go to, if you buy your tires from discount, they'll rotate your tires for free. But I think we need to take the fronts and put them on the back and the backs on the front. And then I want to see if the problem changes. Does it move? Does it quit? Or is it is exactly the same as it was?
Okay. So you think it might be a rotation? That might be out of rotation.
I think the vibration. I think the vibration could be caused by a tire, but okay. It could be either side. So it could be on.
Could be on the left or the right. Okay, because they did take both tires off to put the new bearings in.
Mark is he dropped off for a second. He will be back shortly. Tell us a bit more about your tire.
They took the tires off, of course, when they put the new wheel bearings on and they put that control arm on. I feel sometimes between 35 and 42 miles an hour that there's a slight vibration. I can feel it in the steering wheel, like something's different than it's been all the other years I drove the car. I was just wondering if there could be, since that control arm's been replaced, I'm just wondering if that would make it feel different than it's felt in all the other years I've driven it.
Now it's just shaking. Does it lean to one way or the other?
Nope, and when you step on the brake, the steering wheel doesn't move. It stops just fine, steers just fine, and they say that it's in alignment. So,
does it happen at a certain speed?
Yes, between 35 and 42. Sometimes it starts at 35, sometimes it starts at 40. It usually quits by the time it gets to 42 or 43.
And how long has this been going on?
Just since they put those new bearings and put that new control arm on.
And this happened after the accident?
Yeah, because after the accident, It steers just fine, but it feels different than, I've driven the car myself for 143,000 miles. It just feels different than it did before. So I'm just wondering if it could be, and they say everything's tight, so the bearings wouldn't be off in there. I'm not going to grind anything up with the bearings, you think, do you?
That would be a problem.
Yeah, but I wouldn't know until it happened, but they say it's okay. So I was just wondering if that control arm could make the steering wheel feel different than it had before.
Yeah, that is a problem. Yeah, Mark should be back shortly. Is there anything else you can add?
No. So he said just have him rebalance the front wheels to make sure it's not one of the tires could be out of balance. Yeah, I didn't ask him if they took any of the wheel weights off and put them back on. So if the tire, I know what that happens if your tires are not balanced just right. It almost like it's a little loping in there, which makes it vibrate. So I'll have that done and see if that can change it. Just driving it like that, if that was a problem, wouldn't hurt anything. But as long as the bearings are in there tight, they shouldn't be wrong since they're new, should they?
All right. I'm sorry, Gil. The power supply just on my equipment just started smoking, and so I disconnected it. So I'm going to be on the phone for the rest of the hour, and my clock is still working. Are you there? Okay. All righty. Well, we were talking about Larry and his Explorer, and he's got this vibration that comes and goes. We can sit and talk about wheel bearings and all kinds of stuff, but that's not going to move us forward. My suggestion was let's get the front tires off the front and put them on the back and see what changes. The fact that it vibrates just for temporary or for a little while and then it gets better is something that is more likely associated with the tire than anything else. If we move a bad tire from the front, which is causing a steering wheel vibration, to the back, then the steering wheel vibration will go away and the vibration will come in the seat of our pants, because the vibration in the back of the vehicle is the seat of our pants, and in the front of the vehicle, it's the steering wheel. So that's, if you want a diagnostic process, that's a whole lot better than guessing it's the wheel bearings or it's the lower control arm bushings or it's an alignment or they did this wrong or that wrong. That's just a huge waste of time. Let's go after the problem. And once we determine what the problem is, then we'll know whose fault it is. If somebody takes the front tires off and they go, oh, and nobody tightened up the lug nuts in the right front, then we're done. We go back to the shop and they fix their mess. But it's not going to be wheel bearings, because that's not a symptom that matches wheel bearings. It's not going to be a lower control arm that's the wrong one or installed improperly, because that's not the symptoms for a lower control arm. It's not going to be an alignment, because the alignment's going to cause the tire to wear abnormally, and if there's a vibration, it'll be there all the time. So, like I said, we'll know who to blame after we fix the problem. And my suggestion is to fix the problem is we just move the tires from front to back and back to front. Thank you, Larry. Good luck to you. Thank you very much. We'll take the next caller. Gil, who have you got?
That would be Lauren.
Lauren, good morning. Thank you for calling. How can I help you?
Good morning. I have a 2013 Ford Edge that I bought factory brand new, and I had one issue with it ever since I've owned the car. It's been into Ford Canada, where Canadians do the summer or winters down here. The battery was replaced when the car was a year old because the computer, when you put on accessories, said powering off accessory to save battery. A year later, it was doing it again. I took it back into Ford, and they didn't want to put a battery in. They did a bunch of load tests, and they said that it's basically the alternators in these new Fords do not charge the battery. They only maintain the battery. And everything's been good. When it does that, if I put it on a charger for overnight, it's good for a month or two. We were just on an Asian cruise away for a month. The car sat in Vegas for a month, started doing it again. What do you know about that? It doesn't make sense why an alternator wouldn't charge, would only maintain.
Well, whoever told you that, I couldn't. I would rather talk to them, but from a technical point of view, that's just BS. Okay, that's just what it is. Okay, here's, if you want to fix it, here's what you're going to have to do. There is something that's telling the computer that the battery voltage is dropping. And so if you just go get one of those little testers and plug it into the cigarette lighter, I want you to know that when you turn the key on before you start the car, the voltage should be close to 13. I'll take 12.6, 12.7, 12.8, 13. I'll take that. Then when you start it up, the alternator is going to bring the battery voltage up between a half and 1 volt. So you're going to go from 13 to 13 and a half or 14. Then as you drive it all around town, it's only going to be to 14. Now, if all of a sudden this adapter, this voltmeter that plugs into your cigarette lighter, all of a sudden if it drops down to 9.6 or below 11 and a half, I'm guessing 11 and a half. If all of a sudden it drops below 11 and a half, then there should be this accompanying warning message on there. So now we have to figure out why the electrical system is dropping to 11 and a half volts and the alternator doesn't match those symptoms. So the alternator is like a light bulb. It works or it doesn't. That's all there is to it.
That's what I thought, and I've been driving for a lot of years, and I have plugged in a lighter or the meter into the deal, but I don't remember the readings. But I know 12.6 is around minimum, so I'll try that again. But it's
okay.
Funny. And they said it would take 2,000 miles to drive that car to bring that battery up with that alternator, so it just didn't make sense.
No, you're talking to somebody who's just throwing bull excrement on the wall and hoping that, you know, and if you're talking to a service writer and it's in a big facility, the service writer is not a trained technician, and sometimes they'll just regurgitate the bull crap that they were told by the technician who can't fix your car. I think it's time to take it to a someplace else. Let me ask you a question. Are you in Phoenix right now?
Yeah, we're in Phoenix. We're wintering in Phoenix.
Okay. All right. Take it over to Sanderson Ford. I want to tell you that they have been somebody that I have been able to recommend, and they've never let me down. They've never let my customer down. So I would suggest let's try somebody else, and let's try Sanderson.
Okay. Well, I was in the shop with the technician. He did a load test, and because I had a radar detector plugged in and a couple of very minor things, he said 100 milliamps. That Ford recommends no more than 100 milliamps or it'll pull the batteries down with it sitting 2 or 3 days. So I unplugged all that stuff, and it did help a bit, but it's still doing it.
Wait a minute. This has nothing to do with what you told me. You told me that you're driving or you're idling or something like that, and then the warning light comes on and says it's going to start shutting down your accessories. That doesn't, you know, the draw on the battery when the key's in your pocket has nothing to do with the issue. Nothing. And besides that, the computer draws more than 100 milliamps as the key's in your pocket. It's called keep alive memory. So the computer's going to consume a little bit of electricity, but my wife's Ford Edge, she can let it sit for a week up at the ranch, and it'll always start. She doesn't have an 18 like you do.
One minute.
That has nothing to do with it. This isn't a draw. This isn't a radar detector. This isn't it. We have to determine if the battery voltage is dropping to cause the light to come on, or does the light come on in spite of the battery voltage having a sine wave and a voltage reading well into the normal range? If it's well into the normal range, then we have a bad connection to the body control module, who's supposed to turn that light on. So all of a sudden, the computer sees, ooh, the voltage just dropped to 10. Well, then I better power everything off. Well, the connection caused the voltage to go from 13 volts to 10. So we have to find that. So, you know, you can listen. And first of all, you don't listen to anybody who can't fix your problem. Okay, I can tell you the process. I can't tell you what's wrong with it, but I can tell you the industry standard process. I've given you the best advice I can give you. Take it over to Sanderson. I think they've waved their magic wand a lot of times. I'll see you next Saturday right here on KKNT.
Thank you.